your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed those first two segments with Rick Rule. In the next two segments, we're going to continue focusing on the resource and commodity sector as we are chatting now with Joe Mazumdar, editor of Exploration Insights. Now, Joe, it's been a while since I had you back on the show. It's great to have you back on. And since we haven't chatted in a little while, I do just want to get some broad comments from you starting on the precious metals. Very similar to how we started with Rick Rule on segment one here. There's no denying that the metals, precious metals, and the stocks have been under a lot of pressure. They just went through another pretty depressed month and quarter for that matter. Joe, what's your takeaway from this market right now where it seems like we are back in an environment where sentiment is low and very few investors are actually even paying attention to the metal sector?
I mean, from a contrarian perspective, this would be the time for those people to actually, peak. This would be the time to pique your interest. With respect to the negative sentiment in the gold sector, or the precious metal sector, it's being really led by the Federal Reserve in the U.S., talking about, cutting out the tapering and then, the potential for an increase in real rates, which is what everybody's watching. Every impact people are looking at is getting back down to real rates. And so if they see, even if real rates stay negative, but the trend is, let's say negative 6.6% to 0%. For those guys, that's negative. If they're seeing positive 0.6% going to negative 0.6%, that's great for them and they want to be in the gold sector. What we've been seeing and what a BlackRock executive said several weeks ago before the Precious Metal Summit in Colorado was that, they had a significant position in the gold sector last year in 2020, around the time when gold peaked, but now their position is basically almost zero. So that is the generalist investor that all the mega mergers and all that combinations were there to attract. Like, hey, we've got the market cap, we've got the liquidity, we generate free cash flow, we issue dividends. Just think of us as any other company. But the problem is that the generalists doesn't need to be in the gold sector. They see the gold sector as part of their investment, macro investment thesis that gold is good to be in because rates are negative and are going to stay negative for a while. When that changes, they leave the sector. And even if you comparatively may be the best in your sector, it doesn't matter. They're not interested in that sector. And so that negativity has basically impacted the entire sector. So the sector weakness is basically being led, and you can see it from the producers and the equity side of it, and less so from the gold price. I mean, the gold price is still at a good spot at around 1750 when some major producers are still booking reserves at 1200, 1250. And balance sheet wise, net debt positions are much more favorable than they were in the last cycle when gold peaked at about 1960. And now what we've just seen with another mega merger between Kirkland and Agnico is the industry saying that, we're still interested in scale and we're still interested in, basically generating more value and attracting generalists. So there's obviously a dichotomy between the way the industry thinks of where they are and how good they're doing versus investors. I would say the biggest risk right now for the producing side of it is what I've seen looking at about 15 or 20 companies, looking at their profit margins from last quarter, from the June quarter versus Q3 last year, is what I've seen. It's obviously a bit of a drop in the revenue because of the gold price, but you're seeing a cost creep on average of 10 to 15%. That's having a negative impact on their margins. They're still doing relatively well, but they're doing less well.
Now, Joe, what do you think it's going to take to turn sentiment more towards some of these stocks? Because, the argument has been that the majors are generating some nice cash flow. However, the problem being is that their costs are creeping up and the metal they're selling has also been trending downward for the exploration stocks, there's just no interest. It seems like even good news can be a reason for investors to sell. So what is going to change this broad ignoring of the sector?
Well, I think on the industry side, if we see more M&A, like we're seeing with the Kirklands and Agnico on the major side, if that pervades and trickles down to the non-cash flowing resource companies, that's what will pick it up. Is that when we're seeing quality companies getting taken out, that's what will change sentiment. But like you said, that at least in the North American market, a good drill result or a strong catalyst can still be a liquidity moment for people just to escape the sector, which wasn't what was happening, obviously, several months ago or more. It's different on the ASX. I still see companies there that are putting out good results that are still seeing a good reaction, positive reaction in the market.
Well, Joe, another subsector and stage of the miners that have really gotten beat up are the development stage companies, because A, we haven't seen that big push in M&A, but also I think some investors have gotten bored with them in that orphan stage where they're doing the permitting and the construction and the financing. But you had made a great point the other day about companies that can reinvent themselves and get more focused on exploration, even if they're a developer, and you had used Liberty Gold as an example. I'd love you to unpack that for our audience and how that could reignite the investor interest in companies like that.
Yeah, so we're all probably familiar with the Lassonde curve and an exploration company coming up to basically converting into the development stage in the fall, like you said, about the orphan stage prior to getting into production. But Liberty Gold was on that path. They produced a resource, a new resource at their Black Pine open pit heap leach gold project in the southeastern part of Idaho, which is the northeastern part of the Great Basin, which includes a lot of Carlin-style deposits, which this is one of them. They were all about exploration, and their stock had done really well. And then after releasing the 2 million ounces, which just barely met, I would say, investors' expectations, and then going into a negative sentiment in the gold sector, the stock has pulled back significantly. And I think some of it was also attributable to the fact that they were talking about putting a scoping study and then moving to a pre-feasibility study. And so then the retail sector that is less entranced with that sort of de-risking catalyst, they pulled out. But what they've done now is last year they'd permitted a new area under cover, sandstone cover, that where they have the same package of the stratigraphy that hosts the gold mineralization where they've drilled right now, and they've got the 2 million ounces. They found it in another place called the Range Front, and now they've expanded their drill program from drilling up to 40,000 to maybe 60,000 to 80,000 meters. And so that, I would say, should get retail more excited about the stock, because now it's sort of gone back on the Lassonde curve to more of an exploration play, to saying, hey, maybe we got more resource here before we put a pin in it and do a scoping study.
Joe, are you enticed at all by any of these explorers out there right now that have these large programs? Because we went through this massive financing window, all the juniors, or pretty much all the juniors, cashed up, and then they went out there and started spending that money. A lot of them putting that money into the ground. Unfortunately, that backed up the assay labs, and now they're releasing news in a pretty depressed market. What does excite you about any sort of exploration plays right now?
Well, for me, I mean, I would say like it's thick intersections of continuous mineralization. That's what would excite me. And I see that in some of these companies, and those are the companies I continue to hold, because I think that there's something there that's legitimate that another company would want. And that's what's driving most of the companies I continue to hold. The other reason I continue to hold some of my companies is because they're like a liquidity trap and I couldn't get out of them if I wanted to. But
I hear you, Joe. I hear you, buddy.
Yeah, I'm sure I'm preaching to the choir here. So, yeah, the ones that I continue to speak volumes about in the letter are those that I think they have a legitimate chance of constructing a resource
and a deposit that I think somebody else would want. So that underlying M&A, which would be more sector driven and not investor driven, is really what I'm focused. What Exploration Insights always focused on, but now it even comes more to the forefront.
Joe, how are you handling companies where there's a lot of these, I can think of a couple dozen just offhand, that have very large drill programs because they finally got cashed up a year or two ago. They've deployed the most drills on their property that they have. Some of these companies are doing 30,000, 50,000, 80,000, even 100,000 meters. And so they're massive drill programs, and they're continuing to put out results that are solid, but not really moving the needle much. And what's happening is these companies are growing their market cap, but their share price really isn't going up. And so that might help the company, and that might help some company officers, but it's not helping investors. How do you deal with those kind of value traps?
Yeah, well, the problem is, like you said, is the share structure. I mean, if people just follow market cap, a lot of these companies do double in market cap. But if you notice, the share price doesn't change because they constantly issue equity. Or they've also got warrants that come in, give them money, but at a 30% discount to where they're trading. So, yeah, the underlying issue is that, you know, as an investor, we don't own a royalty. We don't own a piece of the asset. We own a piece of the company. And so we should be as concerned about the value in the numerator and the number of shares in the denominator. And so an overly dilutive company, you know, on a share basis, you may not make any money because, again, you own the share of the company, but you don't own the asset. So you got to constantly think about dilution. But in this market, you know, people are not that patient with exploration programs, not that they ever were. The, you know, these programs take 2 to 3 years. And the problem in the market is, you know, when after you finish your first 6 to 8 month program, and now the assays are even later, and you're not getting them, it's hard to go back to the market and say, okay, we're going to need more for the next program. But right now you haven't had all the assay results, and so your share price really hasn't moved. And so do you go to the market now, or are you going to wait till January, February, when everybody else is going to go up? Because everybody's waiting 8 weeks for their assay results. So you're right. It's something that's happening everywhere, it seems, in North America. And it's probably a little better in parts of Africa and Europe and Australia. But yeah, it's a phenomenon that's not only impacting, you know, share price performance, but in their ability to return to the equity markets, as most of these non-cash flowing junior explorers have to almost every year.
Yeah, that's so true. And those assay labs, it's just disappointing because there's a lot of good work going on. And companies need to get the assays back to guide some of their future drilling, too. So
yes, I mean, that's important. Sector. That's important as well, because if a company is doing an infill program like 50 meter spacing or even 25 or less to, you know, upgrade something from mineralization to inferred category or inferred to indicated, that's easy to do and you don't need the assays, really. You're just going to drill that next hole because that's what the drill pattern suggests. The problem is more in the grassroots, where you're drilling 4 or 5 holes and then you're saying, okay, did I hit it? And then if you've got gold mineralization, which is not visible, which most a lot of times it's not, you don't know if you should drill more in this area or that area. And so that means paying people standby while you're waiting for results or moving the rig somewhere else because you just don't have the results to follow up. Otherwise, you're sort of drilling blind.
So, Joe, before we leave the precious metals, just real quick, are you more biased or do you like gold explorers better or silver explorers better in this environment?
Silver is just, you know, more leverage. I mean, the thing is that there's very few pure silver plays out there, such that if you find one that's high grade and, you know, has a high potential to become a deposit, that should be coveted because there are so few of those. I'm not talking silver equivalent. I'm just talking about pure silver. And that's just the nature of geology. There's just not a lot of those types of deposits. So, yes, but there's so few of those. You know, if one of those drops significantly, that's something that you should consider owning, you know, like a Mag Silver or something like that, or a silver crest.
On the gold side, there's more gold deposits, gold potential, but then you got to think a little bit strategically in that where do the mid-tiers and the majors want to be? Which jurisdictions do they prefer? Is there a plant nearby that they have to feed? And so some of the M&A that we saw last year was incremental, that they had a plant running out of feed and another company had a resource and they thought, well, I could take this and stick it into my plant. So I'll take that. Thank you very much. And so because it's taking longer to permit, in some areas, you know, having that plant is even more strategic now. And if you can get a resource, which doesn't have to be a standalone even now, that could feed those plants, that's another thing that you could potentially see with M&A.
Well, Joe, just shifting focus now over to the battery metal space. We saw a pretty big run in a lot of them, copper, nickel, even some of the lithium, and you could argue that uranium stocks are in the energy metals. But just specifically on copper, I know you follow the copper space pretty well, and we had a nice run in copper this year, and the producers and the mid-tier producers ran first like we normally see, but the junior miners in copper stocks really didn't get much love, and we had talked off mic about it, and you had a couple good reasons as to why you thought that was about where they're at in this cycle. I'd love to get your thoughts on the copper miners, in particular the copper juniors.
Yeah, I mean, the copper juniors, I mean, there have been some, copper plays that have done well, and led by grade, but I'm not sure if they would ever become deposits. I have seen some of those, but I own one that's a developer where they don't have to put in another penny into the joint venture, and it's a relatively high grade deposit in Alaska, and I can see that being taken out. But is there any impetus for that company to take them out at this point, when potentially nobody else would want them? I don't know. But the problem right now is that, in 10 years, when we hit, the paucity of copper production, there's just no projects right now that would feed into that pipeline. And so so for us to get an Exploration Insights to get a junior that's exposed to a copper development project that could potentially feed that supply shortfall, that's hard to get. And that's what I'm looking for. And I'm willing to be patient with those because I know those will turn, retail might not like it because it's not putting out the sexy results, but that's for me a long-term hold. I'm very willing to hold on to that. I also play in copper exploration. The problem with copper exploration in a junior is it's much more expensive than gold. You may have to drill more holes. You might have to drill deeper. And it might not always be possible for a junior to raise those kind of funds perpetually to drill out copper plays. Maybe you could do it on a VMS, a volcanic massive sulfide deposit, which is lower ton and higher grade, but it's more difficult for a porphyry or a sediment-hosted style deposit, which can be kilometers and kilometers. So I would prefer maybe a joint venture partner that was helping a company and saw it more as a 3 to 5 year play.
Well, Joe, what are your thoughts on some of the other copper juniors that really have polymetallic deposits, or there's some that are just copper and gold, and they may be smaller scale, not require the massive capex to get them built like the pure copper plays, but they're in North America, maybe they're in good parts of Australia, but they have the gold credits to make them worth the candle on the precious metal side. Do you like that kind of hybrid gold copper play if it's a junior explorer developer?
Well, the market definitely does, but the question is then who would want it? Is it for a copper company, or is it too small tonnage for a copper company, or does it have too much copper for a gold company, or is it a blend? Because some people, like if it's got 60% revenue on the copper side and it's got gold, silver, lead, zinc, there are intermediate base metal producers that would definitely love those kind of projects because they get a bit of diversity in the metal, maybe that they could take a stream on the byproduct to help fund them. So I'm sure that there's interest, but potentially not by a major producer, but potentially by some smaller mid-tier producers.
So Joe, when you look at the copper space broadly, and there is some good exploration going on, but I think there's also a handful, maybe even 10 to a dozen of these de-risk projects that are lower grade copper, but they do have a large resource and they do show decent economics. However, they're a big price tag to build, and some of them are in good jurisdictions, some are not in the best jurisdictions. Either way, though, there seem to be a number of these assets just sitting there. Do you think that's a hamper on the copper market as well? Because there are millions of pounds that are proved up, but just not getting pulled out of the ground.
Yeah, the thing is that with copper, those, it's just like any commodity. You'll have a lot of marginal deposits out there that are always sitting on the sidelines waiting for the gold price or whatever price, commodity price, to change. The problem with a lot of these assets, and I've done the math on some of them, is that, you know, when the commodity price changes such that you think that there'd be economic, and then you start, you know, adjusting your costs, your operating costs and your capital costs, a lot of the times you find that the return on that capital doesn't change much, you know. But saying that, you know, the Rio Tinto investment into Western Copper and Gold was interesting to me, because here's this, you know, relatively low grade copper gold project in the Yukon that's infrastructurally challenged. But, you know, the resource is well established. Management team is good. You know, jurisdiction is good. But, you know, it's infrastructurally challenged, and, you know, it's got a high capital ticket and marginal grade. But Rio Tinto went into it. And is that being led by the fact that Rio Tinto is having problems in Mongolia expanding into the underground at Oyu Tolgoi? Is it related to the fact that, you know, Peru is, you know, potentially increasing taxes and royalties there? You know, Chile might do the same, you know, and then jurisdictionally it's harder to permit some places, like they're having problems in Superior with their Resolution project. Are they thinking that, hey, you know, I'm willing to take the lower return on the copper grade for the better risk profile and actually developing the project, because these people actually want it to be developed, you know? So that jurisdictional thing, and I'm jurisdiction, people think, oh, the DRC or something. Jurisdiction can also be Arizona. You know, that could be a big risk. So, you know, I'm sure companies are contemplating that, because you could have a really great deposit, as they have with Resolution. And when I worked for Phelps Dodge as a market analyst in 2003, I had that project coming into production in 2010. It's now 2021. And I'm not sure how much closer it is to coming into production.
Fair. I think a lot of people are also sitting on the sidelines saying, well, when, if any of these companies or projects are going to get back into some sort of advancement, really, because they've been kind of sitting dormant for a while. Let's get a quick couple comments on uranium, because look, this year, uranium stocks going through a major run. And then finally, uranium started to play catch up. But a lot of that was simply on the back of the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust going into that open market and buying the excess uranium. That is driving price up. That'll happen when you have a big buyer enter a market. But how sustainable is that in your eyes? And do you think that uranium stocks have topped?
So in terms of uranium, like we know, is that, you know, there's a lot of inventory of uranium that companies meaning the reactors, have been going through, and hence their hesitancy to sign long-term multi-year contracts at higher prices. And so those inventories aren't readily transparent to everybody, how much people are holding, how many weeks of inventory everyone has. But, you know, the difference between the spot and the last long-term contracts that were signed were significant. At what point? Like $20 to $30 per pound difference. And basically you had this match between the producers and the reactors and the power companies saying, okay, well, I'm not going to sign one. And the other is going, I'm not going to sign one unless it's, you know, well over $50. And so nothing ever happened. And I know from Energy Fuels' perspective, they're not, before this run up, they had no intention of signing a long-term contract under these prices. And that's probably the same for a lot of these companies. So now, if now we're forecasting that, okay, $50
is what it's going to be, or 60 to 70, it might be what we need for new projects. You know, will what's happening now in the market lead these energy producers to say basically, okay, I better sign a long-term contract because the gap between the long-term contracts and the spot is closer now, and then I de-risk myself. So whether that happens, I don't know. If that's like in a year or 2 years, I know we're getting closer to this inventory being taken out, but these guys seem to be taking a risk and sitting on their hands a bit longer, and that might happen for another 6 months to a year. I'm not sure. It's obviously had a very good impact on uranium equities from exploration to the producers. Whether it's sustainable, that will all depend on whether these energy producers actually turn around and the reactors say, okay, now we'll start signing long-term contracts. And then the producers say, well, okay, but I want $70. So that's going to be really where this market phenomenon in uranium becomes more sustainable. I have yet to see that, and that's something I'll be looking for. I hold a uranium stock with the idea that that's coming, but I can tell you before this uranium move, that company was doing better because of the idea of using its plant to produce rare earths as well.
Yeah, Joe, you bring up an interesting point too on the long-term contracting cycle, because let's just say that some of these pundits that are saying that's gotten a lot closer now with all the spot price movement higher, that maybe they'll come to the table with the producers and the developers and say, okay, let's do some long-term offtake contracts. But if they do it at, let's say, $60, and then those companies bring production on, what about all the other, you know, 40 to 50 explorers and developers that have run so hard, so fast? Could there be the risk of this just plateauing at that long-term contract price, let's say $60, $65? And has most of the move already been baked into these smaller companies at this point?
Well, I would say they're probably ahead of themselves right now, some more so than others. I would say that, depending on the type of plant that you're running, whether it's conventional or an ISR, I mean, you could probably get away with a 50 to 60 long-term contract and make a $20 per pound margin and say that's good enough for a restart, which doesn't require a lot of upfront capital. I could see people signing those contracts, but they wouldn't be for a lot of volume. It wouldn't be a huge amount of volume. Then the question becomes like, does Kazakhstan come back to the levels that it had before? Is there anything left in their ISR? I know China's, they've been buying and growing resources in Africa and other places where people won't go. And most of those deposits require $70 plus. Because in the end, China knows who the customer is. It's them. So do they want to wait until they need it to start acquiring it? No, they've been acquiring it already. So then the question becomes, everybody else, where are you going to get it from? That's really the question.
All right, Joe, we're going to wrap it up here. I really appreciate you taking the time wrapping up this weekend edition for us. It's great having you back on the show. Everybody, thank you for tuning in to the weekend edition here. And again, please go back through the week on our website and check out a lot of those company interviews that we took part in, as well as some of the other analyst commentary throughout the week. It was an important week for that monthly and quarterly close for the metals. Unfortunately, another down week, but look, there are a lot of stocks that have gotten quite cheap. So make sure that you're in the ones that are doing the good work, and especially right now, do have the cash to keep moving forward. Joe, really appreciate your time, buddy. Have a great rest of your weekend.
Great. Thanks a lot.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment.